Hello, this is Derek Frost from the Triangle Radio Reading Service. For the next hour, I'll be reading to you from the Triangle Business Journal. The content of this program is intended for a print and visually impaired audience. And we start on the front page of the Triangle Business Journal. The headline across the top of the page, Big Builder Rolls Big Bet on Triangle Housing. And this article is written by Amanda Jones Hoyle with the Dateline of Cary. And the article runs horizontally across the top of the page. On the far left, there's a picture of a woman in a business attire standing in front of a fence. The caption reads, Lennar's Trish Hanchett says land is worth the $8.5 million price. As strength builds in the Triangle's new homes market, one of the nation's busiest home builders is stockpiling land by spending an eye-popping $8.5 million to buy 90 acres of wooded acreage in West Cary. Miami-based Lennar Corporation paid top dollar for the land on Green Hope School Road that the Roscoe Fryer family had owned since the mid-1990s. There, Lennar hopes to expand on the sales success of its neighboring Highcroft neighborhoods. The company decided to move forward with the purchase of the Fryer land, even though the Cary Town Council denied a rezoning request in March that would have allowed the developer to increase the lot total from 305 to 350, increasing the potential profit margin for the property. In addition, Lennar will undertake the expense of developing the raw land itself into suitable lots for residential housing with the help of fee developer JPM South Development of Raleigh. Trish Hanchett, Lennar's Raleigh Division President, says the land is worth the cost. With this premier location and neighbors, this project still works at 300 homes, she says. We're all having to look hard and dig deeper for the next best spot. John Myers, president of JPM South Development, says many home builders in the Triangle are beginning to look for potential community sites for 2014 and 2015. The concern is where are the quality lots going to come from, he says. It used to be that residential developers could easily access bank financing to purchase raw land and to pay for the installation of utilities for new home lots and then sell the finished lots to home builders, who would build and sell the individual units to home buyers. It's a very different world than it was a few years ago, says Myers, a veteran of the Triangle's developer market. Because of a lot of shortage, many home builder groups such as Lennar, Pulte Homes, and Ashton Woods have resorted to developing their own lots in new communities around the Triangle in order to keep a steady inventory of new homes. Ashton Woods Executive Vice President Hampton Pitts says he still likes to buy finished lots when he can find them in premier locations, like the more than 70 remaining home sites at Ramblewood near North Hills that Ashton Woods bought in late June for $5.5 million. But when he can't find the lots, Pitt says Ashton Woods will develop the community itself. Ashton Woods currently has four communities in its pipeline that are, or will be, self-developed, including the 227-unit Pemberley community that's open in Apex. Pitt says his group is also developing a new phase of homes at Glen Lake in West Raleigh called Glen Lake Gardens, along with a 13-acre luxury home community called Gray's Landing off Lead Mine Road in North Raleigh, and 7 acres with 69 townhouses adjacent to Davis Park in Durham County. It's a healthy sign that we've corrected the issue of oversupply, Pitt says. There's a demand for quality new houses. On the Fryer site in Cary, Lennar is planning up to 305 single-family homes and townhomes that will range in price from $180,000 to more than $400,000. The project will be alongside a new phase of Highcroft that another national home builder, Pulte Homes, is planning. Hanchett hopes to time the opening of the Fryer community to coincide with the sellout of Lennar's Inside Wade community off Edwards Mill Road in West Raleigh. Inside Wade, she says, has far exceeded all of the company's sales projections. The first phase of 175 homes that started construction in early summer 2011 has nearly sold out, and 20 homes have been sold in phase two. It's a horrible problem to have, but also a blessing, Hanchett says. With Fryer, we want to time it so it's right behind Wade, so there's no misstep in sales or delivery. And moving down the front page of the Triangle Business Journal, we have another article has a black border around it. Inside that border, the top third of it is a picture of two men standing in front of a Cree sign. The caption reads, Cree co-founder Neil Hunter and current CEO Chuck Swoboda at company headquarters in 2004 photo. And then under that in bold black lettering is the headline, Recreating Cree. Now 25, local company closes in on $1 billion threshold. And then under that, there's the article written by Lauren K. Onsorge with a dateline of Durham. Then there's also a little box that says just the facts, and it's in black and red. And it says founded in 1987, went public in 1993, expanded into LED lighting in 2008, acquired Rudd Lighting Incorporated in 2011. And that's the history of Cree. NC State University spinoff, Cree Incorporated, celebrates 25 years this week, and though analysts say they expect Cree to reach 50, the Cree of 2037 may be a different company. It probably will not sell chips, Jefferies and Company analyst Jesse Peichel predicts, referring to the proprietary light-emitting diode LED chips that Cree is known for. In 25 years, they're just going to be selling lighting products. Much of Cree's growth, however, came in the past decade. Cree went public in 1993, just 6 years after it was formed. 5 years after the IPO, the company had more than $40 million in total revenue. And by 2003, the company was pulling in more than $220 million. By 2008, that number had more than doubled to more than $490 million. In its last annual report in August, Cree reported nearly $1 billion in total revenue. On July 11, 2012, the stock was trading near $23 a share, and Cree now has more than 5,500 employees at 33 offices and facilities worldwide. John Palmore, Cree's chief technology officer and co-founder, says Cree will always be a chip company first. After all, it's its own best chip customer, utilizing its own manufactured components for its fixtures. But change, he says, can't be avoided. Palmore has seen Cree shift its focus from semiconductor chips to lighting components to lights themselves. He says that by selling lighting fixtures, it might appear that Cree is in competition with its partnering companies. But we really look at it more as we are leading the way for our customers, he says. We don't try to be the end-all lighting supplier. But the company may need to be. The use of an LED chip in lighting devices is growing like a weed, Peichel says, and to thrive, Cree may have to shift even more of its resources to the devices themselves. It's a shift that appears to have already started, particularly with Cree's $525 million acquisition of Wisconsin outdoor lighting provider Rudd Lighting in August. We acquired them to really combine their outdoor lighting business with our indoor lighting business, Palmore says, adding an official no comment when asked about future acquisitions coming down the pipe. Asian pressure, particularly from China and Taiwan, will also be a determining factor. In the past, Cree had been quite bullish on the prospect of China being one of their major markets, but I do not think that materialized in line with Cree's expectations, Cabelli & Company analyst Hendy Susanto says. Government subsidies in China to Chinese companies is a variable working against Cree. Morningstar Incorporated analyst Brian Colello says, although we don't think any of the Chinese firms are even close to Cree in terms of light quality, they could get there someday, he adds. If China decides to go internally for its LED lighting needs, that market, a big one for Cree, would be gone. Peichel sees the real competition coming from Taiwan, but Taiwanese products mostly go into televisions, an industry Cree lowballed in its 2011 annual report. The worry, of course, is that if Taiwanese companies have technology breakthroughs and want to get into the market, they'll commoditize the high end of the market, he says, bringing up the big question for Cree, how do you stay ahead of commoditization? It goes back to the lumens per watt race, where efficiency is the standard by which you win. Cree is at 254 lumens per watt. It's what keeps Cree ahead of the Chinese and the Taiwanese, Peichel says. We'll see if they can hold on to it. But Colello questions how much it may matter. If they make a light that is 5% brighter than the next guy, how much does that matter in terms of maintaining their pricing, he says. Susanto says that cheaper lights could mean a higher adoption potential, and how fast Cree LEDs are adopted in the market is how the company's success will be determined. By staying in the higher-end market, Palmore says Cree has avoided heavy commoditization so far. But the threat of commoditization, a concentrated point of discussion for Cree executives, keeps him vigilant. And the last article on the front page of the Triangle Business Journal runs vertically along the right side of the page. First, there's a picture. It's of traffic on a rainy day with some cars on the beltway, all with their brake lights on. The caption reads, "Funding law gives some stability to construction sector." And then under that, the headline, "North Carolina to receive $2 billion for road building." This article is written by Chris Bagley with the Dateline of Raleigh. North Carolina will get an injection of just under $2 billion over 2 years for highway construction as part of a recently approved $105 billion federal transportation bill, a level hailed by those in the business of building roads and bridges. The bill passed both houses of Congress with large bipartisan majorities and was signed into law on July 6 by President Barack Obama, who touts it as saving and creating large numbers of construction jobs. About $940 million will be spent in North Carolina in the 2012 to 2013 federal fiscal year, and about $955 million the following year, according to the North Carolina Department of Transportation. Congress has been funding transportation needs for several months at a time, and the 27th-month transportation bill is the longest in about 7 years. The money will go toward projects already on the drawing boards. "It mirrors almost dollar for dollar what we had programmed in our 10-year work plan," says Mark Foster, NCDOT's chief financial officer. He says he can't point to any particular projects that might have been delayed without the bill's passage. Moreover, Foster says the federal government reimburses North Carolina for about one quarter of its state highway spending, a smaller percentage than in most states. Along with Texas, North Carolina has far more miles of state-maintained roads than any other state, about 80,000, compared to about 58,000 miles for number 3, Virginia, according to studies by the Libertarian Reason Foundation. NCDOT maintains many of the roads that in other states would be handled by county governments. A perhaps more important aspect in the new spending law is the flexibility it allows state governments, say Foster and others. The bill loosens the annual limits that earlier bills had put on federal funding for certain types of projects, such as public transit. "This is a much more infrastructure-focused bill than its predecessors had been," says Ward Nye, CEO of Raleigh-based Martin Marietta Materials Incorporated, which supplies gravel and sand to construction companies. Under past iterations of the highway funding bill, it might have taken 2 years for the state to draw, say, $200 million in federal reimbursement for a highway project. Now it might recoup the entire amount in a single year, Foster says. Foster and Nye both point to simplified and shortened environmental reviews for road construction, particularly for widening of existing roads. Nye declines to predict increased business at particular quarries where his company mines gravel, and he says it's likely to be 6 months or more before the new bill is reflected in Martin Marietta's financial results. Nye and other supporters of the bill have said that some state-level transportation agencies have hesitated to put multi-year highway projects out to bid amid the repeated short extensions by Congress. "It keeps the transportation community in a state of perpetual uncertainty," Nye says, of the repeated short renewals. "The new law offers more certainty for the industry." Garrick Schmois, a financial analyst who covers aggregates companies for Longbow Research, estimates that the new bill could add $3.6 million to $5 million to Martin Marietta Materials' annual bottom line. The company, which operates in 26 states, generated net income of $82.4 million in 2011. "I would anticipate there would be some pent-up demand," Schmois said. "On the margin, it is a positive." And now we turn to the biz column, the headline that starts it off, "New Greens Close Old Chatham to Golfers for Summer." Golf courses increasingly are switching their greens from traditional bent grass, which is prone to succumb to searing summer heat without nearly constant watering, to a more heat-tolerant seed called Champion Bermuda. Among them is the exclusive Old Chatham Golf Club, which is closed until September 1 so the work can be done. "We've had no complaints about the closing," says John Marino, Old Chatham Golf Club's head golf professional. "From now until early fall, ground crews will replace the grass on all 18 greens. It's a better playing surface for more weeks a year, says Greg Muirhead, Senior Vice President at Rees Jones Incorporated, a golf course design company in Montclair, New Jersey. The cost for digging out the old grass and reseeding likely won't top $100,000, says Marino. However, because the course will be closed anyway, the club decided to do some other work, including cart path renovations and the addition of some sand bunkers. Combined, the cost will reach about $500,000, Marino says. Old Chatham was founded by some Triangle high rollers who wanted a great golf experience and one that's not crowded. Founders include former IBM board chairman Paul Rizzo, Franklin Street Trust Company president Rex Teeny, and Tar Heel basketball legend Dean Smith. We're trying to make golf fun, says Jim Heiler, former president of the U.S. Golf Association, and an Old Chatham founder. We're really excited about the change. Another accolade for the Triangle. Durham tops the Atlantic Cities magazine list of 20 metros with the largest concentration of the creative class. The creative class makes up 48.4% of the workforce in Durham. Cities trailing Durham on the list include San Jose, Washington, D.C., Ithaca, New York, and Boulder, Colorado. Well, Biz has heard it all now. The North Carolina Aquarium at Fort Fisher is offering the opportunity for folks to own their own fish. But these are fish out of water, as in a corian fish, hand-cut and polished with a three-line message of your choice. The engraved fishes will be displayed at the aquarium, offering visitors the opportunity to remember a loved one, honor a friend, or make a statement, in good taste, of course. The cost is a $500 donation for each fish, which will be displayed on deck boards at the entrance to the aquarium's Adventure Reef play area. The Washington Duke Inn and Golf Club in Durham has been awarded a Pinnacle Award by Successful Meetings magazine. The award recognizes excellence in meeting destinations, hotels, and conference centers. The inn also had been named to Expedia Insider Select List for 2012, an annual ranking of best-reviewed hotels as determined by the online travel agency. The Washington Duke is on the campus of Duke University. It's the only AAA Four Diamond Hotel in Durham. Go Cary! The Cary YMCA Super Skippers team is the 2012 USA Jump Rope National Champion. The team was first in overall speed events and overall freestyle. The team hones its skills at the Cary Y and Apex Gymnastics, according to the website Cary Citizen. The coastal town of Southport is all abuzz with not one, but two movies being filmed. Shooting has begun on Mary and Martha, the working title of an HBO BBC production starring Hilary Swank and Brenda Blythen. Also being filmed, according to the Stateport pilot, is Safe Haven, an adaptation of a Nicholas Sparks novel directed by Lassie Hallstrom. A smartphone app that scans food barcodes and gives a readout of how healthy the food is among 11 ideas submitted in a contest sponsored by Blue Cross and Blue Shield of North Carolina, aimed at finding ways to curb rising overweight and obesity trends in the state. The winning ideas could receive up to $20,000 from BCBSNC for implementation, and Bull City Forward will help coach the entrepreneurs toward that end. In March, BCBSNC launched the Health Innovation Challenge to anyone who has a good idea for how to reduce the obesity problem. Out of 60 entries, the health insurer picked 24 semifinalists to give a short presentation on June 15. From that group, 11 finalists were chosen. A friendly debate has erupted into a War of the Reuben between the owners of Dory's Downtown Deli and Catering and Hibernian Irish Pub and Restaurant, both in Cary. And it will be the St. Baldrick's Foundation that will likely come out a winner in the battle, since both restaurants will be contributing 10% of all sales for each Reuben sold during the month of July to the charity. St. Baldrick's supports pediatric cancer research. Dory's owner, Ray Dory, and Hibernian owner, Niall Hanley, have agreed to let the public decide which establishment has the best Reuben, a corned beef sandwich traditionally served on rye bread with Swiss cheese, sauerkraut, and Russian or Thousand Island dressing. The Cary Town Council, at its meeting on June 28, approved a measure that will actually reduce fees on downtown property owners located within the town's first ever business improvement district. State's downtown business owner and downtown and town councilman Don France in his recent blog. While BIDs are usually created to generate revenue, special tax district, our purpose for creating the BID is to provide the legal mechanism necessary to allow the town to mitigate impact fees associated with private development, and hopefully will incent additional private investment in our downtown, France says. According to Cary Downtown Development Manager Ed Goff, the BID area is focused on the center of downtown Cary and extends about 1/4 mile and focuses on properties already zoned for high-density, mixed-use development. The BID designation will allow the town to reimburse developers in the downtown district the development fees associated with improvement permits that private developers would normally have to pay for a period of 3 years, July 1, 2012, and June 30, 2015. Durham-based Bronto Software says it added 17 employees in the second quarter, bringing the total headcount to 142. That's almost a 50% increase in 1 year. In addition to a previously reported expansion at American Tobacco, the company has moved into a larger office in London and is hiring to support its European expansion. Bronto is an email marketing company that recently added PictureFrames.com and Jawbone as clients. Best of Our State, a weekend celebration of North Carolina featuring music, storytelling, history, food, art, and humor, will be at Durham's Washington Duke Inn and Golf Club August 3rd through 5th. The annual event is sponsored by Our State magazine. The Best of Our State is when our magazine comes to life, says Amy Wood Pasquini, marketing director of the magazine. Booked for the weekend are Elliot Engel, a humorous historian, Daniel Wallace, director of the creative writing program at UNC Chapel Hill, Dr. Adam Perlman, executive director of Duke Integrative Medicine, among others, the Bluegrass Experience, a North Carolina bluegrass band, and John D. Holman, a master bluesman, will each have a concert as well. Contributing to Biz were staffers Jason DeBrun, Lauren Onsorge, and Amanda Jones Hoyle. And now we return to some of our full-length articles in the Triangle Business Journal. The first one we come to is written by Amanda Jones Hoyle with a Dateline of Raleigh. The headline, Harris Teeter to Start Growing Here Again. And along with the article, there's also a picture of the outside of a Harris Teeter store, the one at Cameron Village in Raleigh. The Harris Teeter grocery store chain is moving forward with plans to open 3 additional stores in the Triangle region in 2013, signaling a renewal of confidence in the local housing market. Harris Teeter in 2008 mothballed plans for several new stores in the region when housing market sales started to plummet, but is now planning to move forward with new stores in Wake, Durham, and Johnston counties. Retail developers and shoppers alike are glad to see the renewed interest in expanding from a retail powerhouse. When you see Harris Teeter coming in, it's a good sign that housing is catching up with the market again, says Jim Bromer, president of Wellcor Development in Cary, a retail development and consulting firm. Harris Teeter, based in Matthews near Charlotte, currently operates 24 stores in the Triangle, ranking it number 2 behind Food Lion, which has 166 stores in the region, according to Triangle Business Journal research. Many of Food Lion's stores are in rural areas, while Harris Teeter has typically focused on opening stores in more urban locations. In Wake County, Harris Teeter will anchor the 78,200-square-foot Creedmoor Commons Shopping Center that is under construction at the intersection of NC 98 and Old Creedmoor Road in northern Wake County near Falls Lake. While a relatively rural location, the site is in proximity to Hassentree and other upscale developments. JDH Capital of Charlotte is the developer of Creedmoor Commons and was granted a special use permit by the Wake County Board of Adjustment in December 2010, allowing it to build one of the only retail centers within the Falls Lake watershed. JDH is redeveloping the site where Golston Lumber Company used to operate a lumber yard and concrete plant, says Darren Tewitt, Director of Development Services for JDH. In Durham County, Harris Teeter will be part of the redevelopment of a corner lot at 9th Street and Hillsborough Road, where Jacksonville, Florida-based Regency Centers has purchased land in partnership with Chartwell Property Group of Raleigh. Harris Teeter will anchor the 86,980-square-foot Irwin Square retail building on 9th Street. In Johnston County, Harris Teeter is working with retail developer Crossland Southeast of Charlotte to build its first store in the county. Crossland Southeast is the developer of a 125,000-square-foot shopping center called Flowers Crossroads that's slated to open in fall 2013. The center is located at the entrance to the Flowers Plantation development on NC 42 east of Clayton. The Clayton store is expected to draw shoppers from 115 active residential subdivisions still under construction within a 5-mile radius of the store, says Mike Wiggins with Crossland Southeast. Harris Teeter is also planning to open its first store in Goldsboro in 2013. In the Triangle, retail sources say the grocer could expand even more with its sites on locations near Rollsville, Apex, and Cary. Harris Teeter is the only regional or national grocery chain to submit definite plans to grow in the Triangle in 2013. Harris Teeter opened two stores in the region in 2011, but none are planned for 2012, says Catherine Rule, communications manager for the chain. Company-wide, Harris Teeter operates 206 stores in 8 states and the District of Columbia. Representatives of Lowe's Foods and Kroger say their companies have no plans for new stores in the region in 2012 or 2013. Food Lion spokeswoman Christy Phillips-Brown declined to disclose the company's store opening plans for 2013. Kroger does plan to open 4 new fuel centers at existing stores throughout the area, says Kroger spokesman Carl York. Walmart has 20 locations in the Triangle region and continues to grow its grocery options. Walmart is building a new Supercenter store at the Chatham County-Orange County line that is expected to open in 2013. And it will be opening its first 56,000-square-foot neighborhood market store in the region in October on High House Road in Cary. And moving down the page, our next article is within a black border. At the top of that, inside that border, the top third, there's a large picture of some construction workers inside of a building that they're working on. The caption reads, "Construction is near completion on a massive greenhouse for Bayer Crop Science." And then below the article, there's another picture from the outside of the greenhouse that they're building. The headline in bold black letters, "Growing like a weed, crop science sector bustles with big players." And this article is written by Lauren K. Onsorge with a dateline of Research Triangle Park. Already home to operations of 5 of the Big 6 crop science companies, the Triangle is emerging as the Silicon Valley of agricultural biotechnology, and efforts are underway to recruit the lone company not present. Paul Ulanch, Director of Biotechnology for Crop Development for the North Carolina Biotechnology Center, says he's been in talks with representatives of Dow AgroSciences, based in Indianapolis, about establishing a foothold in the Triangle. No news yet, he says, adding that representatives of the Biotech Center will meet with Dow representatives in the coming months. Dow Agro spokesperson Robin Hine says no move to the area is in the works and that expansions at Dow Agro likely would be at existing sites. Dow Agro is a global company with 27 research sites and 17 manufacturing sites in North America. If Dow AgroSciences, a subsidiary of Midland, Michigan-based Dow Chemical Company, should ever establish an operation in the Triangle, it would join BASF Plant Science, Syngenta, Bayer Crop Science, Monsanto, and DuPont Pioneer. The presence of the 5 companies, their growth, and the potential for more is what prompted site manager for Syngenta's growing Research Triangle Park operation, Bill Lavac, to christen RTP the Silicon Valley of Agricultural Biotechnology. "There are quite a few job postings in Silicon Valley, and no one is moving there," he says of the famed California Technology Center. A new master plan being developed for RTP is designed to give the park a more urban feel, which would make it a more attractive place to work for young talent, says Lavac, who also cites a relative low cost of living here. In the past year alone, agrobiotech's big brands have pledged investments of more than $125 million in expansions in the Triangle. Besides Syngenta, German agrobiotech Bayer Crop Science, which has its U.S. headquarters in RTP, will soon open a new $20 million greenhouse on its campus. And RTP-headquartered BASF announced in February it's investing $33 million to expand its laboratory and greenhouse in the park. A strong talent pool here in crop sciences was a big factor in BASF's decision to relocate executives from Germany to RTP, says Nigel Erms, the company's director of R&D and site services. He says few other sites were considered. It's hard to figure we would move anywhere else, he says. St. Louis-based Monsanto's RTP site lead, Steve Screen, says the presence of the universities and the cluster of companies doing similar research creates an attractive community. Being close to top universities and the North Carolina Biotechnology Center has proven to be beneficial in terms of research and knowledge sharing, he says. Johnston, Iowa-based DuPont Pioneer has a site in Kinston, about 80 miles southeast of Raleigh, that's focused in soybeans. Terry Colbert, research director for North American maize product development for the company, says Eastern North Carolina's large farm sector is a plus. We feel like for our testing and identifying the best products, we need that testing on the East Coast, he says, adding that the Kinston facility is centered among other research sites in Virginia and South Carolina. People talk about life sciences here, Ulanch says, but adds that the big money may one day be in agrobiotech. Even non-agro companies are figuring it out. Just ask Danish enzyme giant Novozymes. Adam Monroe, president of Novozymes North American in Franklinton, north of Raleigh, says his company is working with Syngenta on an enzyme application for seeds. Being in this area is definitely a motivator, he says, adding that if it weren't for the proximity of agrobiotech companies like Syngenta, Novozymes might not have diversified from its other product lines that include detergents and biofuels. And we have one last article on this page in the Triangle Business Journal. This article written by Chris Bagley with a dateline of Raleigh. The headline, "More Questions Seen in Duke's Credibility Issue." Duke Energy may be in for a long slog in its efforts to win back its credibility with investors and regulators following the timing and handling of the ouster of the man who held the CEO's job for less than an evening and the subsequent departure of three of his top lieutenants. In his appearance before the North Carolina Utilities Commission on July 10, Duke CEO Jim Rogers was not fully able to answer commissioners' questions about how Duke's directors thought through their decision to oust Progress Energy's Bill Johnson. And the questioning is probably far from over. Commissioners and other observers have noted that Duke will continue to go before the commission for permission to raise electricity rates, its primary means of maintaining its profit margin. Pledging for 18 months that Johnson would be CEO and then suddenly ousting him can erode trust, they say. The fallout already is having an impact in the financial world. Analyst Jim Von Reisman of UBS cited the credibility issue on July 11 when he cut his price target on Duke shares and his forecast for the company's earnings for the next 3 years. Duke shares closed at $66.50 on July 11. Their 4.8% fall from a split-adjusted close of $69.84 on July 2nd is appreciable in the stodgy world of utility stocks. Commissioner Brian Beatty directly raised the issue of the merged company's credibility with Rogers during the hearing, asking, "Don't you see how that, Johnston's ouster, might affect the credibility of the company before the commission?" More questions may be asked, says Chris Ayers, a partner with Pointer Sproul in Raleigh, who represents utilities and utility customers before the commission. It wouldn't shock me if the commissioners decided they needed another set of hearings and needed to hear from some of the board members, says Ayers. The commission is legally empowered to rescind its approval of the merger, though it would have to consider the effect on ratepayers. The commission's approval was based largely on the expectation that the merger would save hundreds of millions of dollars for the merged company's customers. It's a notable case of corporate chaos that began on July 2nd when the merged company's newly constituted board held its first meeting after the merger documents had been signed. The board voted to ask for Johnson's let's see, in a 10-5 split, with the 10 favoring resignation being the Duke directors. Johnson had joined Duke from Progress, which he led as chairman and CEO until its acquisition by Duke. During the hearing, Rogers emphasized that the expected savings repeatedly, and Ayer says he agrees that the aspect of the merger doesn't change in Johnson's absence. Meanwhile, Duke spokesman Dave Scanzoni said July 11 that the company has not yet replaced three top executives who followed Johnson out: Paula Sims, who had led Progress's efforts to integrate with Duke and was expected to continue in a similar capacity at Duke; former Progress CFO Mark Mulhern, who joined Duke as its chief administrative officer; and former Progress executive John MacArthur, who came aboard as Duke's executive vice president for regulated utilities. None of the three could be reached for comment. Two other top executives who joined Duke from Progress remain with the company: Lloyd Yates, executive vice president of customer operations, and Jeffrey Leash, vice president of energy supply. Scanzoni says the two are busy with the post-merger details and not able to comment. Rogers, meanwhile, has met in Raleigh with numerous managers and employees who joined from Progress in recent days, and Scanzoni says Rogers expects to continue the process in Florida. Raleigh and Wake County officials say they haven't heard from Rogers yet, as they regularly heard from Progress officials, but hope to do so soon. And now we turn to the A Better World page. News about people and groups in the Triangle making a difference with their giving and philanthropic activities. And this page in the Triangle Business Journal starts with the nonprofit news. The North Carolina Community Foundation, NCCF, has achieved the highest accreditation designation as determined by the Community Foundations National Standards Board, an accreditation organization of the Council on Foundations, COF. The National Standards Board compares the distinction to the Good Housekeeping Seal for community foundations. The Lucy Daniel Center in Raleigh has received a $10,000 grant from Cisco Systems to help fund SecurePath, a program to provide free mental health services to underserved children who are experiencing behavioral and emotional challenges. Established in 2005, SecurePath provides mental health services and limited casework in English and Spanish. The services are provided in the environments most accessible to both parents, almost always either in the home or child care facility. Through a donation card campaign, customers of Harris Teeter grocery stores have given $553,000 to the American Cancer Society's More Birthdays campaign. The March campaign encouraged customers to help create a world with more birthdays and less cancer by making a $1, $3, or $5 donation. The campaign was an amazing success, says Ed Lord, Vice President of Business Development for ACS. And now we have the Philanthropy News Desk column written by Todd Cohen. The headline, Girl Scouts Grew Under Sinclair's Leadership. And along with the column, there's a picture of a group of Girl Scouts all crowded together. And the caption reads, Racine Mitchell Sinclair celebrates Girl Scouts 100 years with the kids. One of every two women in the U.S. was a Girl Scout, according to estimates by Girl Scouts USA. The Girl Scouts North Carolina Coastal Pines is counting on a lot of those women to help girls become scouts and leaders. You can't be something you haven't seen, says Racine Mitchell Sinclair, who has served as the Raleigh-based council's CEO since August 1, 2007. It's so important for girls from all of our areas, whether major cities or rural areas, to have role models. Mitchell Sinclair credits her own experience as a Girl Scout in a small town in southern Illinois with helping to equip her for a corporate career that included 25 years at IBM, most recently as the vice president, corporate officer, and senior state executive for North Carolina. After retiring from IBM at age 55, she joined the Girl Scouts as CEO 2 months before councils based in Raleigh and Goldsboro merged to form the current council, which serves nearly 33,500 girls, ages 5 to 17, as well as 10,000 volunteers. In her 5 years as CEO, the council's membership has grown by 6%, while contributions from individuals, corporations, and foundations, which account for 10% to 12% of its $8.5 million annual budget, have grown by 86%. Now, as Mitchell Sinclair prepares to retire from the Scouts on January 31, 2013, the council is sponsoring a series of events and raising money as part of a $1 billion campaign by Girl Scouts USA for its 100th anniversary this year. The goal is to boost equal representation of women in public and professional life over the next generation. All 41 counties the Coastal Plains Council serves have held local celebrations this year that included community partners, elected officials, and donors, as well as service projects ranging from food drives to volunteer work for nursing homes and animal shelters. And the council produced At the Speed of a Girl, an exhibit at the North Carolina Museum of History that celebrates North Carolina women involved in the Scouts. Operating with service centers in Raleigh, Goldsboro, and Fayetteville, six camps, and a full-time staff of 61 people, the council generates 71% of its revenue from the sale of Girl Scout cookies, a program for girls that grew by 3% over the past year, and in recent years has included a special effort that has donated more than 1 million boxes of cookies to military troops. The council, which has adopted standardized leadership programs from Girl Scouts USA that provide girls with age-appropriate journeys, focusing on advocacy, the environment, and self-esteem, has launched initiatives that aim to boost high school programs in science, technology, engineering, and math. The Girl Scouts is about women sharing their stories with girls and teaches them social responsibility, volunteering, community, and the value of community service, as well as the opportunities that scouting can lead to, Mitchell Sinclair says. Those are lessons and opportunities, she says, that you cannot be exposed to and learn from, that you cannot not be exposed to and learn from if you're a Girl Scout. And our final section in the A Better World page is the People on the Move. Senior Pharma Assist, a nonprofit medication assistance and Medicare insurance counseling program in Durham, named the following to three-year terms on its board of directors: Tijuana Bazemore, project manager at Measurement Incorporated; David Cachetto, a pharmacist at Lincoln Community Health Center; and Carolyn Titus, retired Durham County deputy director. Senior Pharma Assist named the following officers for fiscal year 2013: Stephen Detrick, president; Mary Sappenfield, Vice President; Evester Bailey, Treasurer; and Cheryl Lloyd, Secretary. Hospice of Wake County named Brenda Gibson to its Board of Directors. She is a licensed real estate broker and member of many philanthropic boards. Gibson will serve a three-year term for Hospice of Wake County. George Sharp, a project development manager at the IBI Group of North Carolina, PC, was named chairman of the Kraft Family YMCA Advisory Board. He takes the reins from Karen Bird, who has served as Kraft YMCA Board Chairman since 2010. And our next article in the Triangle Business Journal is written by Lee Weisbecker with the Dateline of Raleigh. The headline: First Citizens dips into cash to exit unfavored securities. A half dozen small bank acquisitions made by First Citizens Bank shares since July 2009 have not only paid off by giving the Raleigh company more retail exposure in prime markets, the deals also have been profitable, bringing in $150 million in 2011 alone. Now those gains will be used in part to help First Citizens shore up its capital base from the effects of one of the thornier matters in federal financial reform. It has to do with the fine print rule making that has followed the passage of the Dodd-Frank law. Those rules are aimed at defining how much and what type of capital banks should be holding. One provision, aimed at larger banks with more than $15 billion in total assets, would require them to stop counting trust-preferred securities, or true PS, as part of their Tier 1 capital. A bank's Tier 1 is its key measure of core strength and the amount against which it makes loans. More than 1,223 bank holding companies, large and small, including First Citizens, over the years sold True PS, a preferred stock paying interest, as does a bond, to investors as a way of raising capital. It became a popular way among bankers to avoid selling additional common shares and thus diluting the holdings of existing shareholders. Now that True PS are losing favor among regulators, the great pullback has started. With nearly $244 million in True PS outstanding, $21 billion total asset, First Citizens, like other large banks, has announced it'll start buying back its trust preferreds. By July 31, the bank is expected to take steps that will result in the redemption of $150 million, or 62%, of its total True PS obligation. Holders will get 102.4% principal plus due and unpaid interest, according to a First Citizens filing with the U.S. Securities and Exchange Commission. Regulators have set deadlines for the large bank phase-out that begin in 2013 and stretch until 2015. A slew of large banks, including BB&T, PNC, Fifth Third, and Bank of America, also are launching redemptions. Each has its own buyback scenario, but in First Citizens' case, the revenue generated by its six small bank acquisitions comes into play. That extra money will allow the bank to finance the redemption while remaining well capitalized under regulatory standards and without having to raise additional cash from investors. First Citizens executives say as much in the company's recent annual report. Since we have not historically raised capital through new issues of our common stock, we seek to replace the Tier 1 capital provided by the trust preferred securities in part through acquisition gains arising from FDIC-assisted transactions. Bank spokesman Frank Smith adds that acquisition gains over the last 3 years have provided sufficient incremental capital to allow the redemption of these securities to occur without the need for additional capital to be raised. The bank expects to take a charge against earnings due to the early redemption, Smith adds, but should also begin to see a savings on its interest expenses beginning in August. It has been paying 8.05% to the holders of its True PS. First Citizens, Smith says, has made no additional plans at present to redeem its remaining trust-preferred securities. Regulator dislike of True PS, says bank analyst Don Coker, has to do in part with the fact that the security has a maturity date or end date, as does a bond, and they would prefer to see permanent capital in the form of common stock, he says. As the larger banks move to clear their books, some 633 smaller banks, assets of $500 million or less, also hold True PS. Dodd-Frank previously excluded them from the phase-out. But according to Charlottesville, Virginia-based SNL Financial's Tyler Hall, regulators in early June began considering another change that would strip the smaller banks' True PS of their Tier 1 status, but over a 10-year phase-out period. The news came as a bit of a shock to smaller banks, Hall says. Move afoot to roll back or abort renewable energy goals. That's the headline on our next article, this one written by Chris Bagley with a dateline of Wendell. A key state legislator is considering legislation to eliminate requirements that certain percentages of electricity be derived from solar energy and animal waste as utilities struggle to meet some of the requirements. While utilities and developers are ahead of schedule in meeting an escalating series of targets for solar energy, they say they're highly unlikely to meet their first annual quotas for hog waste and poultry waste in 2012. Utilities will eventually have to derive 7.5% of their output from alternative energy sources such as wind, solar, animal waste, and other biomass. Within that broader quota are 0.2% minimum set-asides for solar power and hog waste, and a smaller set-aside for poultry waste. Representative Mike Hager, a Rutherfordton Republican who chairs the House Committee on Public Utilities, says he and a bipartisan group of legislators get together in January to study a possible modification or the elimination of those set-asides so that utilities would be free to choose some alternative energy sources over others. The shift could save money for businesses and other electricity customers, Hager says. Duke Energy Carolinas, Progress Energy Carolinas, and the state's other utilities have been warning the North Carolina Utilities Commission for more than 2 years that they're unlikely to meet the 2012 set-aside for hog waste. They jointly reiterated that warning and asked for a one-year reprieve from the hog waste requirement in a June 1 regulatory filing. The commission tentatively denied the request on June 21 and asked for additional supporting evidence. Ivan Urlaub, director of the North Carolina Sustainable Energy Association, a trade association, says eliminating the set-aside for solar would be a bad move. "We're definitely open to changes to hog and poultry, to discussing and negotiating through changes there," Urlaub says. Utilities and developers have registered plans to build at least 10 generating facilities that would run on hog waste, including one or more on a farm southeast of Wendell. With a cumulative total of a bit less than 17 megawatts of total capacity, according to NCSEA, that's enough to power just 0.15% of the homes in North Carolina, depending on how consistently they run. The state's utilities, including Duke, Progress, rural co-ops, and municipal utilities, have jointly signed 7 contracts with developers for generating electricity from animal waste. Utility representatives say they've had to terminate 4 of the contracts after the developers missed deadlines. One of the few facilities in North Carolina that already runs on swine waste is an experimental 65-kilowatt operation that Duke developed on a farm in Yadkin County in conjunction with Duke University and Google, which operates a data center nearby. "One of the things we've learned is that there's not as much production as we thought," Duke spokesman Jason Wall says of the plant. Wall says his company has signed power purchase agreements with some independent developers, but he declines to say how much electricity those produce or will produce. In terms of revenue generated, North Carolina's hog industry ranks second only to Iowa, with farms down east generating $2.3 billion in 2010. Bacteria in vast lagoons of swine waste near farms produce methane as a byproduct of digestion. The electricity generators use the methane as fuel after heating swine waste to 120 to 130 degrees to accelerate the bacteria's digestive process. One goal of the hog waste quota is to capture escaping methane, which has a much stronger greenhouse effect in the Earth's atmosphere than carbon dioxide. Lloyd Lipman says bacterial digestion, a woefully outdated technology, and a key reason why utilities are unlikely to meet their quotas. The Renaissance Organization, LLC, the Alexandria, Virginia-based energy company, of which Lipman is chairman, plans to use a new technology in a 5-megawatt generating facility near a Duplin County hog farm. It would extract water from the pig effluent and then gasify and burn what remains. In an effort to meet their own quotas for hog waste power, North Carolina's 2 municipal power agencies are soliciting proposals for one or more facilities that would be able to generate a total of 2,000 to 10,000 megawatt hours of electricity annually. The agencies are co-owned by and distribute power to Apex, Clayton, Wake Forest, and nearly 50 other North Carolina municipalities. And now we turn to TriangleBusinessJournal.com. Here's some of the news you may have missed on TBJ's website. Raleigh, "We expect Duke to meet with us every quarter." Duke Energy CEO Jim Rogers has not yet met with local government officials who are accustomed to hearing regularly from representatives of Progress Energy, which Charlotte-based Duke acquired July 2nd, even as he makes rounds among his 11,000 new employees in 3 states. But that doesn't mean there are no expectations from Raleigh leadership. Officials say Progress managers had met quarterly with the city manager and mayor, and that the 2 officials expect those regular meetings to continue under Rogers. In the months ahead, he definitely plans to meet with local officials in the Triangle, as well as in Florida and other areas formerly served by Progress, Duke spokesman Dave Scanzoni said. A spokeswoman for the city of Raleigh said Rogers had not yet requested to meet with Mayor Nancy McFarlane or City Manager J. Russell Allen. Wake County Manager David Cook also hasn't heard from Rogers, his scheduler said. Quintiles Allscripts signed partnership. Morrisville-based clinical research organization Quintiles has entered into a strategic partnership with Chicago-based Allscripts, one intended to jointly develop software to improve drug development. The partnership aims to help customers leverage the large amount of data already available, including data about the regulatory process. This data could enable companies to improve the efficiency of processes involved in the development and evaluation of new drugs, the companies say in a joint statement. American Airlines ponders merger partners. American Airlines is prepared to consider a merger if it stays independent after existing bankruptcy, CEO Tom Horton told employees Tuesday. American and parent company AMR Corporation will begin contacting interested parties to explore its options, Horton told employees in a memo obtained by Bloomberg News. U.S. Airways Group Incorporated has expressed interest in merging with Fort Worth, Texas-based American. Executives at U.S. Air, which has headquarters in the Phoenix area and a major hub in Charlotte, have focused their comments on American rather than its corporate parent, and it isn't clear what would become of sister airline American Eagle. North Carolina falls to number 4 in business ranking. Depending on how much stock one puts in such things, this is not good. North Carolina fell from 3rd to 4th among CNBC's 6th annual list of America's top states for business. Although CNBC said North Carolina fared well in several individual categories, such as workforce, transportation, and technology, the state couldn't hold on to its number 3 rank of last year. North Dakota was announced earlier at number 5, while the remaining results will be announced throughout the day, with the top state announced by study creator Scott Cohn on CNBC's Closing Bell. Duke's Rogers board raised questions about Progress's Johnson in May. There's always some twists and turns in a big merger, such as the one between Charlotte's Duke Energy and Raleigh's Progress Energy. But what transpired at the North Carolina Utility Regulators hearing goes beyond the normal twists and turns. Almost 18 months after the merger was announced in January of 2011, the Duke board started questioning Progress CEO Bill Johnson's capability of running the merged company. Duke Energy CEO added the final decision could only be made after the merger was complete. And we're going to stop there as we've run out of time for today's episode of Triangle Business Journal. Be sure to listen at the same time next week. I hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Derek Frost, reading for the Triangle Radio Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for a print and visually impaired audience. This program is readily available as a podcast after the broadcast. Our phone number, 919-832-5138. So long until next time.